This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Something big and complicated is going on and you feel you'll never get your head round it. Me too. But give us 28 minutes and the top experts in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room and we may be able to sort it out. This week, Brexit. It's almost upon us. Where have we got to? All through the pandemic, the Brexit clock has been running. As the weeks and months of lockdown have passed, British and EU negotiators have been talking, sometimes virtually, sometimes physically, sometimes with urgency, sometimes not. Sometimes the mood has been encouraging. Usually, it hasn't. And now the time has just about run out. So what have we missed while we've been preoccupied by the extraordinary exigencies of the pandemic? And where are we almost imminently headed? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. There was the withdrawal agreement, the political declaration. There have been seven rounds of talks and intensified talks. So where have we actually got up to? Time to call in Katja Adler, the BBC's Europe editor.
Last year, we were talking about the divorce deal. So that's known as the withdrawal agreement. And that was about us getting out of the European Union, which we did. We did that at the end of January. And the divorce deal basically dealt with three main issues. The money that we still owed, having promised as members to the European Union. It was also about citizens' rights. So the rights of EU citizens in the United Kingdom, UK citizens who are living in the EU, what their rights would be after Brexit. And dare I say the word, backstop, the Irish backstop, remember that? How much did we discuss that? That was aimed at trying to keep the border open on the island of Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, not just for economics, but for the peace process. The backstop was replaced in the end, but with something that was actually, you know, quite similar in many ways to the original proposal. So that was done and agreed, and that is now an international treaty. After Brexit on the 31st of January, there was then preparations for trade negotiations. What is our relationship going to be like? And originally, that was so much more than trade. You know, how do our police forces cooperate together after Brexit? What about justice? What about research and development? You know, scientific projects. I mean, for me as a journalist, one of the main questions I was always asked in the lead up to Brexit is, what does it mean for travelling with my pets to the European Union afterwards? I mean, there were so many questions about how do we untangle this more than 40-year-long relationship and how do we build it back up? And the original vision that Theresa May had, if you like, is very different to what Boris Johnson then said he wanted. And that's where we often hear about this bare-bones FTA, bare-bones free trade agreement, or people are using a lot of coffee analogy these days, a skinny FTA. What does that actually mean? We don't quite know yet, actually, because there are still quite a lot of subjects under discussion. But it's about more than trade. It's about more than the UK aiming to get tariff-free, quota-free access to the European Union. And we should also know what it doesn't mean. Because even though tariff-free, quota-free sounds, oh, that kind of sounds like status quo, doesn't it? Absolutely not. And often people now say, well, we've had Brexit in January and nothing's changed. Well, that's because we're in that period that's called the transition period. And what it means is that even though legally we have left the European Union, in practical terms, things are staying the same. For the moment this year until the 31st of December, and while negotiations continue, we remain in the single market and customs union. So you're not feeling it, you're not seeing it yet.
Okay, and just to be super clear, certain things had already been decided. For example, EU-UK citizens' rights were agreed last year. That's done.
Those three main points in the divorce deal that I spoke about, they are done, but done doesn't actually necessarily mean implemented. So that means you still have ongoing questions about UK citizens in the EU. Will they be able to vote in municipal elections, for example, like that? Will they be able to move from Germany to live in France? Here, too, there are still rights for EU citizens where there are certain question marks or people still have certain fears. And basically, it'll be pretty acrimonious if this ends in a no-deal situation. And at the moment, I'd say we're probably 55% probability that we will get a deal, but 45% not.
Also joining us now is John Peet, political and Brexit editor at The Economist. John Peet, can I just ask you a question of clarification? What happens if and when a deal is agreed?
Any deal has to be approved by national governments. It has to be voted on and approved by the European Parliament. If it's a very complex deal, what we call a mixed deal, it might have to be ratified by national and even subnational parliaments. But I think the deal they're talking about trying to reach in October or possibly later, given the time frame, they would want it not to be so complex. So it really just has to be approved by national governments, the British Parliament and the European Parliament. But that can take time.
Sorry, John, are you saying that we might actually settle for a less complex deal purely because otherwise we would have to get it ratified by these other parliaments and we don't have time?
I think that is one of the reasons for avoiding a very complicated trade deal. I mean, previously, some trade deals, the Canadian trade deal with the EU, has taken several years both to negotiate and ratify, and I think they want to avoid that. So yes, it is a reason for going for a simple deal, possibly one that could be built on later.
Okay. Katja, can you just remind us of what the timetable for talks actually is between now and the end of the year?
Well, at the moment, the cutoff line supposedly is October, which means that we've got two negotiating rounds up ahead now in September, and frankly, no realistic prospect of having breakthrough then. There's already talk, and I have to say really completely unsurprisingly, of having to have emergency talks or an emergency summit in October. And I think that, you know, even though this deal would need to be agreed by the member states, by the 27 EU countries and ratified by the European Parliament and the UK Parliament, I think that you could be pushing into November, and Angela Merkel said something similar a while ago, or she sort of possibly slightly muttered it under her breath. I think you'll have a sense of déjà vu. You know, we talked about the withdrawal agreement last year. Again, everything was pushed to the last minute, and it wasn't until the two sides saw the whites of each other's eyes, et cetera, that it became clear what compromises they were both going to make. I mean, the art of the trade deal is for both sides to be able to go away at the end and say, we got X or we got Y. But I think you're hearing trade experts warn about this leaving to the last minute escapade, because even if this is a really narrow free trade agreement, this is a free trade agreement. So I think there are those trade experts warning, don't leave it. Don't be so overconfident, UK or EU, to leave it to the last minute. And I think, just one more tip, David, I think you might start hearing also about implementation period. You might have heard that before, but possible then that if there is the likelihood of a deal, that then there's a 3 month, 6 month, whatever period of where we say, OK, it was very last minute in making this deal. We now need X or Y period in order to implement it.
OK, let's look at what the sides are trying to do and have been trying to do. John Peet, what in broad terms has the UK wanted from these talks?
What Theresa May wanted was quite a comprehensive deal, including quite a close customs relationship that replicated as far as possible the goods trading arrangement we had as members. Boris Johnson made clear when he came in that what he wanted was what he called a Canadian deal, which is just a free trade deal that means no tariffs and no quotas, and that would be it. He didn't want any of the sort of paraphernalia of regulation and so on to avoid non-tariff barriers that would go with that. So what he is seeking is a bare-bones free trade deal covering goods only that does not involve aligning with EU regulations and does not eliminate non-tariff barriers and doesn't get rid of all customs checks and checks for what is called rules of origin.
Right. So that was his position. What is your understanding about what British negotiators are now confident or hopeful of actually achieving?
The truth is that the two sides are still far apart on quite a lot of issues. But what the British negotiators want to achieve is something that does not in any way subject the UK to European rules or the European Court of Justice, does not mean we are bound by the European Union's rules on state subsidies to industry, what's called state aid, and does not involve giving the European Union or European Union vessels the sort of access they have now to British fishing waters. And the British negotiators believe they can get a deal that does avoid those things.
They still think, the British negotiators still think, that they will get broadly everything they set out to get at the beginning of these negotiations.
What both sides are saying, in effect, is it is for the other side to move. Otherwise, we can't make progress. And because neither side is willing to give ground on these key issues of particularly state subsidy rules, the level playing field for competition and fisheries, neither side is prepared to move, we are not making progress.
But almost any negotiation you would have thought is you go in knowing you'll have to give up something and they'll have to give up something. Do they have an idea about what they are likely to have to give up to get their deal at the moment?
If you're asking that about the British side, I'm not sure they do. They have not set out any clear idea of what sort of regime the British government is willing to accept to constrain its ability to subsidise industry. They've not set out any sort of clear guidance on what sort of rules they will follow on state subsidies. The EU has been clear that it won't offer a free trade deal giving British companies access to its market unless there are some rules and some understanding about state subsidies and the following of regulations quite similar to the EU's. And I don't think the British government has been clear on what it wants. It's just said it is a matter of sovereignty and we want to preserve the right to do what we like.
So, Katja Adler, what from the beginning has been, if you like, the EU's bottom line? In other words, not its greatest hopes, but its expectation of what it could achieve.
Well, we're way, way off the EU's greatest hopes because it sees the UK as a very close partner, the EU looking with concern towards Beijing, the EU looking with concern towards Moscow, the EU looking rather perplexed towards Washington. This is not the time that it wants to split with its best friend. So for geopolitical reasons and also economic reasons and in its own economic interests, it wanted to keep the UK as close as possible and as less of a competitor as possible to its own businesses and its own single market. I think what the EU always said was, you know, quoting the Spice Girls, tell us what you want, what you really, really want, because it wasn't what about the EU wanted. The EU never wanted the UK to leave. So once we were leaving, they wanted to know from the government, what is your bottom line? What is it you really want? Because when you make it clear to us, we can tell you within our rules and regulations what is actually possible. So I think when we look at sort of the two sides sort of pointing the finger at each other saying, you move, no, you move right now, even though it's late in the day, posturing, not unusual. Not unusual, because there is still time, even though it's ticking away, to get a deal done between the two sides. But I think, as John has pointed out, the real things we're looking at here is fishing. It doesn't mean very much to the European economy. It doesn't really very much to the UK economy. It's massively symbolic for those French fishermen, for the Spanish fishermen, and for the fishermen of the UK as well. And so that is a real sticking point. But I think it comes down to state aid. How much will our government give or want to give to failing or UK businesses or businesses in trouble? And what that comes down to is the EU saying, we want to give you tariff-free, quota-free access to the single market, but no way are we going to let you undercut our businesses in their own single market. So we hear a lot about the EU always gives up in the end. But state aid, I think, is a bottom line here.
Katja, state aid is, of course, only one way in which a government can privilege its industries over the industries of another country's. Less expensive regulation would be also another classic. Are they worried about that?
Absolutely. You know, environmental regulations, tax, labour regulations. But you have seen the two sides coming much closer on that, with the UK giving the impression that it would be willing when it comes to environmental standards and labour regulations, that they would be willing to say, OK, look, we've left the EU now, but we would be happy to say that we'll stay at the levels we are now and that we'd agreed together when we were a member. And if we go away from that, then you can impose tariffs on us or, you know, punish us, quote unquote, in some way or another. We're not there on state aid. And that really is, as I say, is, you know, the EU really, really wants a deal, David, but absolutely, you have to believe them when they say not at any price, and don't expect Angela Merkel to come riding to the rescue on this.
John, what deal, if any, do you think the UK and the EU are likely to come to by the time all this comes to fruition?
I would certainly say that there is a serious risk there will be no deal. I would put it close to 50-50. But if there is a deal, I think it's going to have two components. The first is that the British will say, we accept some constraints on our ability to give state aid to industry. These are the rules we're going to follow. And we agree with you that if you think, the European Union, that we're breaking those rules, you have the right to retaliate. It wouldn't be quite the same as observing all EU state aid rules as they are now and as they will change in the future to the letter. But it would come close to that. And on fish, I think the UK would have to agree to some multi-annual agreement that does allow access to UK fishing waters, but gives British fishermen much higher and rising quotas of what they can catch. On the rest of regulation, I think the current sort of idea that we won't roll back from current levels of regulation is sort of going to be part of the agreement, but not a commitment to observe any changes in the future.
Catcher, you're nodding.
I'm nodding. I agree with John. I think if there's a deal, that's what it's going to look like. And I think that's where you're going to build on from. Because, for example, travelling with your pet after Brexit, whether you can do that or not, or whether it's, you know, access to medical care in a European country after Brexit for UK citizens. Those are the kind of things that you can look to building onto once a trade deal is in place. And I think those are the arguments that are being made for it's better to have a deal than no deal, even though I think you can expect Conservative backbenchers, you know, very sort of passionate Brexiters in the autumn to be saying much better to have a clean break, to take back control as we promised and forget constraining ourselves in any way about labour regulations, environmental regulations or state aid. In Brussels, they think that the decision, deal or no deal, lies in Downing Street and nowhere else. They will find out, they believe, in October, is this about ideology, taking back control over everything, or is this going to be about economic pragmatism? And they don't think that Boris Johnson knows yet. They think he wants a deal, but he will have a look at the political landscape a bit further down the road to decide whether he's going to make the compromises or not.
Katja Adler and John Peat. So now we know the timetable for the talks and what each side has wanted from them and what Katja and John think are the most likely outcomes. Now I want to know what happens after they're over, when the transition period ends and the UK's new, more distant relationship with the EU begins on January the 1st, 2021. Joining me in the briefing room are Maddie Timont-Jack, a senior researcher on the Brexit team at the Institute for Government, and Professor Anand Menon, director of the UK in a Changing Europe initiative. Maddie Timont-Jack, how important is it to reach some kind of agreement, however thin it may be?
Well, it's a really good question because there has been a lot of discussion about the fact that there isn't that much of a gap between no agreement at the end of the year and an agreement, but it does make a difference. So if you're thinking about all the checks that need to take place at the border, an agreement could mean that there are less checks, so that means it's less costly for business. It will also, because both sides are looking to agree a sort of a deal that removes the need for tariffs, so sort of taxes on trading goods, then actually it will also make quite a big difference for those industries where the tariffs are very high. So for example, motor manufacturing, you'd be looking at a 10% tariff on cars being traded into the EU. And if you've got very thin margins as a business, then suddenly having to find a way to pay additional tariffs if there's no agreement at the end of the year would be very challenging.
And what about the politics of it? I mean, does it make a psychological difference that you've come to an agreement between the two sides, even if it's not a particularly fabulous agreement?
The EU is our nearest neighbour, and actually there are going to be things that we'll want to cooperate with them on, even just in the space of sort of foreign policy and defence. And if we haven't been able to reach an agreement, then the sort of relationship between the two sides are not going to be in a particularly good place. And it's also worth saying that last year, when we were preparing for no deal, there was sort of some steps put in place both from the EU and the UK side to try and ease some of that friction. So, you know, to allow planes to continue to fly and to be able to continue to sort of drive trucks in the EU. And if we haven't got an agreement at the end of this year, then those sorts of measures, the UK government could still choose to do that, but the EU is less likely to. And I think they're really going to want to put the sort of the screws on us a bit, because they will want us to come back to the negotiating table and agree a sort of way to make it easier to trade between the two sides. I mean, the other thing is around security, and that's actually quite important because we do rely on data sharing with our EU partners to, you know, keep citizens safe.
And let's talk scenarios here. And in the first instance, let's talk about the possibility that there isn't a deal, and we say at the end we can't agree. What happens then?
Well, if there's a bad-tempered bust-up and both sides walk, then I think, as Maddie intimated, you are set for a rocky period in relations between us and the 27, both the 27 collectively and the 27 individually. You'll feel the change in the political mood, but also when you get to the 1st of January, you can expect to see significant disruption because the EU, I think, is less likely than it was this time last year to put in place mitigations. And so far fewer trucks will be able to cross the border into continental Europe. It'll be harder for goods to travel over here. You might see some shortages in the short term. People have talked about potential for shortages in fuel and some sorts of food. As it gets harder to get things in across the border in good time, while particularly with food products, they're still fresh.
Now, let's imagine that we do get a deal, but the deal is the kind of deal that John Peat was talking about, which is we give some ground, the UK gives some ground on state aid, agrees to align with EU rules, that there's an agreement on fish, the UK does slightly better there than some of the intimations have been, and it's just a free trade agreement on goods only. Now, if that is the kind of deal, what would that look like for us as business people, as us as consumers, as travellers?
Well, there are three big issues to bear in mind. Firstly, in aggregate economic terms, it will be less damaging than having no deal. That's to say the overall economic impact will be smaller. Secondly, and crucially, it will ease the flow of goods between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. If we get a deal, it will make the border between GB and NI far softer than it would need to be under no deal. And it would help some businesses. So manufacturers would benefit from the absence of tariffs. You will see trade being easier for, say, car manufacturers, aerospace manufacturers, and so on. On the other hand, large swathes of economic activity will be untouched. There'll be virtually nothing in this deal about services. Our economy is 80% services. Those who export services to the European Union will find it far, far harder to do so. So what we'll see, I think, is there will be some initial disruption. And over time, what most economists expect is we'll just see growth being lower than it would have been had we signed a more far-reaching economic deal.
I imagine that all this is going to mean even more emphasis on the other trade deals which Britain could hope to do with other countries. Now, where do we stand with those?
With Japan in particular, we seem to be making pretty rapid progress, and it's perfectly conceivable that a deal will be finalised within the next 2 to 3 weeks. With South Korea, things are slightly slower. With the US, as far as I can see, things are effectively on hold because of the presidential election. But it's worth saying that, yes, these trade deals will help our trade with these other countries. But when it comes to making up for lost trade with the European Union, we trade so, so much less with these other countries than we do with the European Union, that the positive impact of even all these trade deals going through smoothly will in no way make up for the economic impact of losing that trade with the European Union.
Now, Maddie Timont-Jack, when we talk about these disruptions, given the scenarios we've been painting, what would that actually mean?
The UK government has basically said at the moment, they said, look, we're not going to be able to implement full border checks. We know businesses aren't ready. And to be honest, the government isn't ready to do that. So on the UK side of the border, they've said they're going to ease in checks over a period of 6 months. So some sort of provisions will apply from day one in January, but other checks will come in April and then in July next year. But on the EU side of the border, they're saying checks are coming from day one. So the challenge is that if lorries get to at the ports on the UK side and they don't have the right paperwork, they will get turned back. And that is what the government is currently trying to manage. So they are setting up sites in Kent so that they can sort of turn parts of Kent into a lorry park. They're also saying that they're going to be checking paperwork away from the ports to make sure that those lorries do have the right paperwork before they get there, so we don't have sort of jamming up right on the ports because there's just not much space around them at all.
So are these temporary lorry parks, which will disappear once we have sorted these problems out? And if they are, do we have any notion of how long that process would take?
So there are some sort of infrastructure sites that will be permanent, and then there are other measures they're putting in place that will be more temporary as they hope hauliers get to a point where they do know what paperwork is needed and slowly that change comes through. And I think the point to make is that even if UK government was fully ready, given how unprepared business is, because, you know, they've been dealing with a huge amount this year. There's been a lot of oxygen taken up with focusing on responding to the coronavirus pandemic, and they haven't had the space to prepare for Brexit. Until that sort of filters through, we know there will be disruption, and the government won't be able to know quite how long they'll need to carry out those checks before they get to the border.
Anand, you refer to the Irish border, and I think maybe it's time to be a little bit more specific about it. What are we going to see there after January the 1st?
Well, the whole point of the Northern Ireland Protocol was that when it comes to the former border, the intra-Irish border, we will see very little change. There'll be no checks, no customs posts, no cameras put in place there, because that was something both sides were keen to avoid. But the price you pay for that the moment you come to leave the single market and the customs union is that because Northern Ireland finds itself effectively in bits of the single market and in the EU's customs territory, is that the EU will insist on that goods coming into its market from GB will need to be checked. So you will see changes at Northern Irish ports where you have to have the infrastructure in place to carry out the checks the EU will insist on goods and agricultural products coming in from the United Kingdom. And as I said, the more far-reaching the deal, the less intrusive those checks need to be, because ultimately it's a sliding scale. We'll end up towards the no-deal side with a fairly hard Brexit and so the need for checks.
Fairly obvious question, really, given that we're now in August. Have we built those checks yet?
As part of the ongoing negotiations, the EU is monitoring implementation of the protocol. Privately, you can hear EU officials muttering that those arrangements aren't in place yet. So it will be a work in progress. But yes, the work is underway. And I think that the government are saying by July, everything will be ready.
And Maddy Timont Jack, I suppose the same thing goes for the famous lorry parks. Are they now built? Are they now fully operational?
I think I have to agree with Anand on this. It's work in progress. I think they've identified sites and they are starting to put in place those plans. I mean, I'd say in terms of anticipating having to sort of check lorries have the right paperwork before they get to the ports, these are plans that the government put in place ahead of no deal last year. So to an extent, they do know what in theory they need to be doing. But I think that the difference with this year is last year, it was a lot of a fingers crossed we won't have to. Whereas this year, we know that they definitely will have to, agreement or no agreement, just because of those additional checks on the sort of French side. And because the short straits are so narrow, actually, as soon as you get sort of a bit of build up on one side, it will have an impact on the other. And that's, again, another big concern.
And what does that actually mean? I mean, am I not going to be able to get that I was able to get, or am I going to be delayed in getting that I was able to get easily before?
One of the questions a lot of people have is, will there still be food on the shelves? And I think it's worth saying that the government will be planning for and hoping that, yes, there will. But if there's a challenge getting fresh food from the EU because the border has got jammed up, then, yeah, we might see a more limited range of food on our shelves. It's worth saying that during coronavirus pandemic, you know, we were all stockpiling. But I think we can probably agree that actually largely the food supply chain did hold up. We increased, for example, the amount of pasta we were importing from Italy. And we really did rely on that, the imports from the EU, as some of the more international supply chains were impacted by coronavirus. The difference this time is that it's the EU supply chains that will be under pressure. So I think there is a concern that ministers may be more lax about it because they know that it was fine during coronavirus. I mean, the other thing it's worth saying is that we've used a lot of the medicine stockpiles that were built up last year ahead of no deal, responding to the pandemic. So that will be another concern for the government. Now, last year, they procured ferries to ensure that we could get medicines into the UK. And they will be reactivating some of those contingency plans this autumn. So I wouldn't want to cause panic, but it's definitely going to be, those are the sorts of things the government anyway is going to be planning for to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Maddy Timont-Jack there and Anand Menon. And my thanks also to Katja Adler and John Peat. And my conclusion on this, if there's a deal, it's likely to be a thin one, even though both sides will declare themselves to have been great negotiators and to be fully satisfied. And then there will be almost frantic talk about the excellent deals that are to be done with non-EU countries. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirsty Knight, Alex Lewis and Joe Kent. It was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including on how to negotiate a trade deal, on Scottish independence, and on schools and the coronavirus. You can find them all and much, much more on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.